Welcome to Lang Time Chat, episode 42. Hi, David.
Hi.
How are you?
I guess I'm all right. How are you?
You are my special guest of the episode. You've never been on this show before, I don't think.
I'm always pleased to make guest appearances and always pleased at how well I'm remunerated for those guest appearances.
Cool. I do have a very shiny penny at the end of this recording that I can give to you. All right. So last time we left off in the middle of a kind of lengthy discussion on Romanization.
Mm-hmm.
So our intention had been to have one episode on sort of a best practices of Romanization. And wouldn't you know it, we ended up going way over an hour in our recording last time, and we never made it to the blank page document where David was gonna like type some things and talk about some best practices in his opinion. This is of course opinion based, really.
Mm-hmm.
As much as David doesn't want it to be opinion based, it kind of is. And so we're gonna start there today. So David.
Yeah. Now, and as a reminder, especially if you're able to look at the screen here, when we talk about Romanization, what we're talking about is something like this. I'm going to pull up this layout here. Go ahead and change paragraph background to this, and I'm going to type.
As he's typing, the paragraph background that he chose for this document on the screen is a very dark gray. And then he's typing in, you know, just regular black font over it. And so what he has typed so far on the screen is, and I'm going to type here, I'm totally making a paragraph that looks super cool using some text that I'm making up on the spot while Jesse's reading it. That is true. The best thing about David is his incredible mind. It's getting kind of slow here, David. You need to type faster. I find myself dreaming about being as incredible as he is. This is the paragraph. And yet, all I can do is squawk like a bird. Oh my god, but you put squack. You put squack. Okay, momentarily it said squack. That is what's on the screen right now. And again, all of that is with a dark gray background and black text.
Yeah, and here's the thing, like, you can read this. It's just not a very nice or pleasant experience, especially if all you want people to do is read the text. If the point is reading the text, then using black font on a dark gray background is probably not a good idea. As is not using, for example, and I love this, by the way, bright red text on, on a bright blue background.
Okay, but Mr., as I've got this pulled up to the side, what you'll see on the other half of the screen is David's web thing. And let me tell you the color schemes of that web thing. This is literally what these links look like on your website. You really need to redo it.
Hang on. So what I discovered and something very interesting is that if you do bright red text on kind of a blue background.
Royal blue, very bright blue.
Yeah, it evokes 3D.
Yeah.
And so back in the old days when we had America Online and we would text each other, you could have formatting wars between you and the person you were texting with. Because when you sent a message via their instant message service, you could change what the font was, what the font color was, you know, its weight in italics and so forth, and the background color. And when you sent the text, it would override the previous settings.
Oh.
And so, you know, sometimes you would just throw on this to mess with people. Actually, my favorite.
It's actually giving me a headache to look at it.
Exactly. It is giving you a headache to look at. I want you to remember that. One of my favorites actually was this. It's like a bright yellow and dark gray, and it reminded me of streetlights. Anyway, so the point behind talking about Romanization as something different from orthography is that the entire point of a Romanization system is for somebody to read it, and that's really it. And so if you do something like, you know, have the bright red text on bright blue background version of a Romanization, it may indeed be something that you enjoy, but it's not very accessible. And in fact, can be quite the opposite. And so that is why, you know, Romanization has to be separated out from orthography as a separate thing. Generally, Romanization is also separated out from transcription, which can be its own thing. And, you know, it can be not only difficult to write in transcription, like an IPA transcription, but sometimes it's not as helpful as something that removes some of the layers of detail that transcription requires. Or, you know, things like, for example, if you have a bilabial fricative or two bilabial fricatives and you don't have any labiodental fricatives, it may be more accurate to use the IPA symbols and you may be, you know, try or be interested in developing some other way of writing it to indicate that it's bilabial. But it's not very helpful for Romanization because we're working with the Roman alphabet.
Right.
If there were some different alphabet that regularly made distinctions between these two, then of course, you know. But we're working with essentially just the most commonly used letters of the Roman alphabet. Anyway. So that was a summary of last episode. Now onto this one.
And so one thing I do want to...
Go like, for it.
Because we're talking about, you know, like IPA versus Romanization. And for me specifically, when I think about like why Romanization may be important, especially for language creators, is sharing your work, especially if it's part of a fictional world or, you know, whatever. And if, you know... Your character is talking and mentions how much they like the local leather produced in the region. Okay, so like I type the sentence, if your character is talking and mentions how much they like the local leather produced in the region, dot, 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 because that's not actually a period because I did not create a whole sentence there. But I wrote leather in IPA, and it doesn't look like it necessarily belongs in the font. And, like, it can get really interesting because IPA fonts, depending on what font you're using to set the entire work, is not always going to render. So some of them will look kind of funky because they won't all render correctly anyway. But it also just, it doesn't look like it belongs. I'm actually going to put that in italics because normally, and we'll talk about what just happened. Mm-hmm. Normally when a word is used in another language in the middle of a text, it'll be like in italics or something to set it off. Right. In this particular font, which is the beloved Palatino X, and I say beloved because I have, since David introduced it to me, fallen in love with it. It's the one that he made based on Palatino, the more regularly known version of it. And he made his own version, which works really well with IPA characters, except some of them are not rendered in the font in italics and bold. And in the word leather, the epsilon, that sound in IPA is not rendered in the font correctly. And so suddenly you get like this beautiful italic of the L, the ez, the schwa, and the upside down R, but then the E is like in a very obviously different font face, and it just like jumps out at you. But it also just doesn't look like, I don't know. If I'm reading a book and if everything were done in IPA, it actually, even as a linguist who studies and understands IPA, I feel like it just wouldn't go with the flow, especially if I'm reading in English. And so I'm just going to really quickly type how that may look. Mm-hmm. In romanization, you might have leather as L-E-D-H-E-R, you know, where the D-H is the that kind of thing.
You know, it occurs to me we could make this a PDF and then share it afterwards.
Oh, totally.
But I'll wait till afterwards to reintroduce the red on blue.
Thank you. So I don't, and by we, specifically me, I don't know if you're mm-hmm. able to tell your eyes to ignore it, but like, it was too much for me to stare at. Yeah.
Yeah. It's the type of thing where it's like, you know, Q followed by H bar standing for the vowel is just too much to stare at.
That's very true.
Yeah. Anyway, where are we going? You had taken over. Where were you taking us?
Us there. I was saying that, you know, if in the middle of a string of text where somebody is just talking and you want to have a word in your conlang, I think romanization just looks smoother, even though it may not capture all the pronunciation things that, you know, you would be able to capture in IPA. I think that most people would be able to grasp how to produce certain things.
Now let's talk about other ways that we might do this.
And David is coming up with a way that leather, the word leather.
No. Let's see. I think I might need to
switch over to the IPA keyboard.
No, not the IPA keyboard. Need to go to Unicode to pull up some of the inventive forms of R I've seen used.
What is this OPQ thing? What? OI. That's OI.
Yeah, ligature.
And so if you're a big fan of ligatures, there's some fun ones in here.
And then let's throw in, yeah. Okay, so then what I have written here is word leather written in some kind of fanciful romanization. So because of the unique way that L is pronounced, it was decided that the L should be spelled H, and then L with a slash through it. And then the vowel, the main vowel of leather, is rendered with an E with a grave accent, followed by an A with a circumflex accent. And then the eth is actually done with a delta, which you can find on just an extended ASCII keyboard. It was decided that the vowel schwa should be done with an apostrophe, and just an apostrophe. And then there's the R that has a hachek over it for the R. And then, of course, there's the O with two grave accents above it, which is not pronounced. So,
as it shouldn't.
Yeah.
It's, you know.
Now, often when you see things like that, and you have somebody who looks at it and says, wow, this is really funky, the conlanger will respond with, well, it's just my aesthetic. That's not what this is. This is basically you've created something inaccessible. And so it is precisely the type of thing where if you enjoy it, you may use it with yourself. But for somebody else, you need to develop a romanization because that is not what this is. This is just a mess. It is actually what it really ought to be understood as is it is a personal orthography. That is, it is an orthography developed for just one person, the creator. It's not a romanization. It's just a mess. It happens to use Roman characters for lack of imagination, I guess. But it is not a romanization. It's just a disaster. So, anyway. Moving on.
Well, okay, so off to the side, I have your website pulled open.
Yeah.
Because somewhere on here is the, is it, no, that's not that.
No,
that's the sign language IPA. Somewhere on here you have the Romanized.
The Petersonian English alphabet.
Petersonian, that's right. Mm-hmm. Oh my God. Okay, now first of all, can we talk about the fact that I struggle with the color scheme everywhere?
It's dark blue on very light blue.
Is normally? What is normally?
That's normally. Now, okay. Do you want to just
black
do...
black and white. There we go.
Yeah. It's a little garish.
It's little
hard
bit.
On the eyes.
It's too... What's a dark chocolate? Ooh, no.
No, the other one.
Milk?
Yeah. You like that?
No.
Really?
Yeah. Like, I like black and white better.
Yeah.
But...
Let's see if this still works. Let's see. What are some others that you might... About this dark green on light green, you like that?
I'm just, it's like there's too much color, and like this is the table.
Oh yeah.
Anyway, yeah, I struggle with a lot of. Oh, this is good. The green is very green on the outside. Oh wait, is all the text going to be green though?
Yes.
No. Oh well, we'll do. What's beige and brown? That. Oh, that's the dark chocolate, huh?
Yeah, I personally.
Well, we'll stick with dark chocolate.
I think that's the best.
Okay.
It doesn't work anymore.
Well, if you go down there, it does.
Sure, but like it was supposed to, stick around for the whole website. Oh well, I guess the JavaScript broke or whatever.
But the Petersonian alphabet was David's reimagination of the English spelling system.
Mm-hmm.
Which is just a Romanized,
I mean, this is an orthography.
It is. Sorry, but like my brain totally stopped for a second. Are you just pointing out that people don't know how to spell consistent?
Yeah.
Okay. I just caught that out of the corner of my eye and I was like, why did David spell consistent with an A?
Yeah. But it's because like, you know, there's tons of hits where it's spelled that way.
It's basically how could you use principles behind mm-hmm. Romanization with English, but of course certain decisions
right.
still have to be made, which means that at the end of the day you're still producing, like David said, a new orthography.
And you
have to, the big thing, like one of the reasons, like anytime I talked about spelling and pronunciation in classes, in terms of English, students are always like, why don't we just change it? And it's like, well, whose accent are you going to use?
Mm.
And of course in their minds, they're like, well, I want it spelled the way I say it. Mm-hmm. But that doesn't really help when English is spoken around the world. And so many different accents. So this does also, at some point you do have to prioritize whose English you are reforming in terms of the spelling system.
Regarding this, that was actually the fifth point in terms of how I was designing the system. It
yes.
went along with destandardization, so there was no longer going to be a standard.
Well, how about, David, you talk us through the five principles, which I think are principles you could apply to any kind of practice.
That's
of,
true.
Of Romanizing something.
So the first was no diacritics, which is something that I find very helpful. And this goes for the and again this was proposed kind of as a joke, you know, the Petersonian English alphabet. It goes for that, but it also goes for Romanization systems in general. It is ideal if you can get away without diacritics. And especially coming from the point of view of somebody who's using an English language keyboard, there's extra keystrokes that are involved with diacritics. We can commonly access some of them, and they are the diacritics that are most common in European languages. They are the diacritics that are most common in Western European mm-hmm. languages. So it's like if you can get by with using those, sure. Otherwise, it's one thing for reading, because I mean, you know, I think that especially as the years wear on, even American English speakers are coming to understand diacritics better and better.
Mm-hmm.
I think this is largely due to sports. Either it's largely due to sports or it's largely reflected in sports, where now we're getting better at pronouncing non-American or non-English names. So reading is one thing, producing is the other. And it's like, if your goal is either writing this yourself or somebody else writing it, it's a pain in the butt to have to go search a bunch of diacritics. So that was goal number one for this, no diacritics. The second goal was no new characters. So in other words, just work with A through Z. And that is, it's kind of the same point as with diacritics. So in other words, like you could, as with IPA, IPA has gotten new characters from lots of different alphabets, primarily Greek, but also, it got something from Russian, didn't it?
From IPA?
IPA, or was it just Greek?
I mean, I know there are some that are not in the Greek or the Latin alphabets.
Sure, and then there's, yeah.
But I'm trying to think, I don't know the Greek or the Cyrillic alphabet well enough to be able to say if we pulled from others.
Yeah, I don't remember, and they may have been gotten rid of. But like, for example, it's kind of the same thing as a diacritic. An acute accent over an E is a character you recognize with a little bit added on top of it that's not touching it that you might not recognize. An L with a slash through it, it's kind of like a diacritic, except it actually produces an entirely new character. Mm-hmm. But the point is, you're not going to be able to produce it very simply. So that was the other issue.
Not going to be able to produce it very simply. In some cases, now some of these characters are much more easily produced because keyboards have gotten a little bit more savvy with the way mappings work. So, like,
especially on a phone.
Especially on a phone, where you can hold down and you get all the different options presented right there. So that you can definitely get around that. But I will say, with some of the characters that people fall in love with that they want to use, and you had specifically mentioned this on your website, is like the Thorn, which I love, by the way.
Sure, yeah.
I am a fan of the Thorn. I love, I wish that English had held on to the Eth and the Thorn much longer than they did. But it really does look like a P with a line attached to it. And mm-hmm. So like there's a reason why maybe Thorn didn't stick around that long. The one that I think is the worst from, if you know Old English text, is the Win.
Oh, yeah.
The Win is the Ya character, or the Wa character. I don't know why I said the Ya. The Wa for Win character, but, like, it looks like a P. It, for all intents and purposes, like, the only difference between the P and the Win is that the Win is kind of written with a bit of a sloopy slope as it comes down and attaches to the line. Otherwise, it just looks like a P. And, like, so there's a really good reason why that letter did not stick in comparison. But, like, some people who see Old English think, I want to invoke that in my own romanization system. But if you use it, it's just, like, going to be super confusing. And so, yeah, you definitely... Even if you do use a character that's not necessarily a part of the Latin alphabet, but it is a character that most people would recognize, like a beta or something like that, or like an SF from
mm-hmm.
German.
Yeah.
Like, one thing you do want to make sure is that it is very recognizable and something that wouldn't be confused. And so it's like using the ash with the AE smashed together. Like, I feel like that one's much more recognizable.
Yeah.
Cross-linguistically, cross-languages with speakers. And so it's like, I could understand if you decide you want to use that. David may not understand. I could understand. But at the same time, like, if you decided that that character, the ash, should be pronounced, ooh, then I no longer understand. Like, if you're going to use the ash, it really needs to be like an a or an it pronunciation like it is in the languages that it's used in naturally.
Yeah. By the way, this is going on to type design, but one of my biggest issues with Win is that it not only looks like P, but it looks like an italicized version of P.
It really does. Yeah.
And when you're designing a writing system, It's like the characters need to go together. And so, like, if you've produced a letter that essentially looks like it belongs in an italic version of your font, and the rest of the characters look like the regular version of the font, something is wrong. Do you know how to call it up?
Well, I do if I go here and get some emojis and symbols. And it should be under Latin.
That's it. Right there,
do you
right?
see it? Oh, yes. It sure is. Here's the capital. Okay. So I have the win in both capital and lowercase forms, which I'm going to move them around because the capital should be first, obviously. And so I do have it on the screen. So if you've never seen it, you can pull it up or look at the PDF attached to the post for the podcast to be able to see it. And it's got for the and then win behind it.
Yeah.
And again, it looks like a P, but like when the P is italicized, the whole side of it gets a little swoopy.
Yeah.
The whole line slants. And so I've also put italicized P up on the screen. But with the win, it's like straight up and down, except it's like the hoop from the P was italicized.
Yes.
And like that's the only difference, really. Ish.
It was destined to fail there. Anyway, that's just something to keep in mind when designing a writing system. So the third point I think is the most important point, and that is recognizability. That is like the entire purpose of romanization is so that somebody else can read your work. And it's not so that they can be impressed by the romanization. That's really not the important point. The important point is the conlang, right? And what you're writing in it. That's what you want people to read and understand and comment on and be inspired by. Romanization should be a window to your conlang, not an impediment to it. And so when you are making choices, you want to design it based on recognizability. So, like, you can use the letter Q for cha, you can use it for engma, you can use it for glottal stop, but will English speakers who look at that Q recognize what the heck it is supposed to be? Now, in terms of using it for its IPA value, there is, at the very least, IPA is an international standard. You know, whether it should be the international standard or not is frankly an argument for 100 years ago. It's the international standard now. So if you're going to use something for its value in the IPA, you have at the very least, so even if Q doesn't look familiar enough to be, you know, English speakers don't generally know qua, and if they look at Q, they think it's going to be qua, even if there's no U after it. At the very least, you have the saving grace of, well, I have used the form that is the international standard. It's something that it doesn't hurt you to learn anyway. Learning that in my conlang, Q makes the r sound, that doesn't do anything for you outside of this conlang.
And no one's going to remember.
Yeah.
But I put up the line kala versus kala with a K versus a Q. Because if your conlang has both a K and a Q in it, in terms of the IPA values, right? And you have character names, and like one is a QALA kind of name, and you know, it'd be kind of weird to have two characters as Kala and Kala, but it could happen. But just saying, like, there could definitely be value, like David had said, in using the Q to represent that difference. It would be something that a lot of readers would have to learn. One thing that is frustrating is when people just use Q without understanding that it has a certain sound value. And I know David is very, I will say famously, pointed out that Dothraki and Valyrian both have the Q because words were just spelled with a Q in the books.
Only that, there's contrasting, at least in Dothraki, there are names that have Q with you.
Right,
and names with Q without you. And so it was clear that one of them was supposed to be pronounced the way we would find familiar, the kwa, and then the other one was supposed to be different.
Right.
Otherwise, why write it that way?
And so,
And George R. R. Martin, when he was doing this stuff, he's not the type of writer to do things haphazardly or randomly, right, or forget what he has done previously. Other authors sometimes are fall prey to that. I won't name names. And so with their stuff, you can just kind of...
Yeah. Fair.
All right.
Okay, so yeah, recognizability.
Okay, and the next most important is regularity. In that if it's spelled this way and it's pronounced this way, it should be spelled and pronounced that way every single time. There are plenty of natural examples where that doesn't happen, but again, these are all orthographies. Like, I have no idea why they decided with Malagasy, which is a five-vowel system, they decided to write E at the end of a word as a Y, like it is in English.
Oh, no.
Yeah, that's why it's spelled Malagasy with a Y.
With a Y. I never thought about that. Mm.
It's a very quaint and consternating feature of the writing system that was developed for that language. But, again... And that is the type of thing that you will see in an orthography. It's not the type of thing that you should see in a romanization system.
And remember that for an orthography, there's a history behind it, and there's usually a reason. And in fact, oftentimes the reason for that difference in spelling is that it used to be pronounced differently. And so, like, that's a lot of times, not always, but a lot of times it's a historical preservation where the pronunciation has shifted and it's no longer pronounced, which is also why, like, so many things in French are air quote silent letters. I did my air quotes there for you. Where, like, historically they were not silent letters if you trace it back far enough. And it's, you know, they just stopped being pronounced, but they were still spelled.
Yeah. This last point is really more for this project, you know, where I was respelling the English spelling system, and that was destandardization. It's not really relevant, I think, for a romanization for a conlang, but the idea was that there are many different Englishes throughout the world, and no, you cannot say that one of them is the main one and the other ones are the variants. So instead, everybody just spell things how they think they should be pronounced, and just be good with that. So, you know... Like, that means that spellings may vary region by region within a country. Spellings may vary from different countries. And, yeah, it'll take a little bit of work to learn it, but you know what? That's not a terrible thing.
But then you also get just the straight-up mispronunciations that you would never know what I'm saying half the time in my writing if I spelled how I think the word is supposed to be pronounced.
Well, it's up to people David from your region to look at that and say, what the heck is that? And then, you know.
And so you can only communicate with people in your region.
But, I mean, for a lot of times, though, you can figure it out from context. And then, you know, it's a type of thing that could be an interesting little quirk. So, for example, if we were using the Petersonian English alphabet to write, and we follow this principle of destandardization, then I would write this word.
Oh no, is that really how you would do it?
Yeah, so we have...
Why are there so many Y's?
We have the English word appreciate, and I would spell it that way, along with, I would say, 99% of English speakers. But Jesse...
No, you would not. 99,
would
no.
Spell it this way. Appreciate. Which is the... She is the only person I've ever heard pronounce this word this way.
You've never heard appreciate?
Not once. Not once. And in fact, the first time I heard you say it, I thought it was a mistake. The second time, I thought it was a mistake, too. Or that, like, you were doing, like, some sort of an accent or something, and I couldn't figure out which.
I feel like we need to poll people and find out how they say this word.
I don't think you're going to want that.
No. Why wouldn't I want it? It's, I think, interesting to learn.
Sure.
But wait. Why are there so many Y's in this?
Oh, hold on. We're getting ahead of ourselves.
Okay, I was just trying to figure out in your vowel chart what's happening.
There are three other things I wanted to mention, and this is just for this spelling system, but like, because I think these are very important. So like names, I wanted to mention names are unique and should be unique. So it'd be like, well, what's my name spelled like in the new system? It's like, well, however you want. And I think that that goes not just for if you're instituting a new spelling system, but I think it goes for always. So there are certain people that get a lot of flack for very unique spellings of names, especially in America right now. Honestly, I think it's fun. Just go nuts with it. I mean, I think it should be easier for adults to, you know, who got names as children, to be able to change the spelling of their own names.
This is how I used to want to spell my name.
There you go.
When I was a kid, I was like, ugh, I've got, I mean, Jessica was a name of the 80s. And so, like, mm-hmm. I was in a grade with, like, three other Jessicas. Most of us went by Jesse or whatever. But, like, it was a very common name. And so, like, I wanted to stand apart. I wanted my version of, so it's like I like my name, but I want it to be different. And so I wanted to spell it G-E-S-Y-K-A.
Yeah, and I, for one semester in college, told people my middle name was Genesis, spelled with a J, because I hate my middle name. That was really the only reason. Anyway, so it's like, yeah, spell names however you want.
Get mail however you want.
And then, like, for names of, like, foreign cities and countries, just spell them the way they spell them, because, I mean, it's not that big a deal. And foreign words should be spelled the way that they, you know, are going to be spelled in the languages that they come from. It's like, you don't need to be somebody who's going to go about like, oh, all those words need to change their spellings now. Unless it becomes like a really, really super common word in English, and then maybe. Anyway, so that was the point. And then regarding, you know, how I did this, because remember, this is an orthography, not a romanization. I wanted it to make sense for English. And the truth is, most of our long vowels, that is the non-low long vowels, they, whenever they're followed by a vowel, they have a glide in between them. And so it made the most sense to just say, all right, the short vowels are just the vowel, the long vowels are the associated glide after that vowel. The only place where that didn't really work was ah. And honestly, this is one of the most awkward combinations in English, ah followed by a vowel. It rarely happens. And in fact, we had repair strategies for this in the past. This is why you had law and lawyer and saw and sawyer. But like you can say it now, like if you're say somebody's sawing something, you could say you're a really good sawer. And it's just kind of awkward, and it's terrible, and I was like, well, whatever, let's reflect that in the spelling, how awkward and terrible it is. But otherwise, when you have something like, and then let's see, let me make sure I have that, So if you have somebody who's, C, right? C would be S-I-Y, and then a seer would be S-I-Y-U-R, seer. And the vowel is just right, or the glide is just right there for you, and it's all ready.
Okay, I, by the way,
yeah.
want to point out that David and his system
mm-hmm.
went with a C for a K sound instead of a K.
Yep.
Because, let's see here. I happen to like C better than K, recognizability be damned. Even though recognizability was one of your top five features, I personally would choose the K, not just because K is obviously a superior letter than over C, but also because when you see a K, it's pronounced K. Whereas when you see a C, like it's pronounced in so many different ways that I think it could be confusing. And then it also, I think, really helps that the CH would really be one of the only places you would ever see a C in the system. And so it's always a ch, so you don't even have to think about it.
So remember that this is an orthography, not a romanization.
I know,
it is actually less jarring to switch to C than K for the majority of spellings of K in English. Cat is still cat. C-A-T.
I don't think you're going for not jarring people when you see how appreciate is spelled. Like, that's jarring. It doesn't matter. Like, so you're all about jarring people. It's just you don't want to jar them with the K switch.
I don't think it's too bad.
It's very jarring. There's a lot of Y's in there.
What's wrong with Y?
It's when appreciate has
appreciate, three. Right?
I don't know. When I see an O, I think O. And I gotta go over here to what the
just
O is.
A single O is just schwa.
Interesting.
And check it out. Controversial. Yeah, honestly, a lot of times that just an O shows up, like in sun, actually is just schwa.
Wow, yeah, there are some decisions I would not have made. Wait. How do you even say plot?
Polt. You know, like the, you know, Harry Potter.
Interesting.
It's something that's thrown in there. It's only for British. There's this great gif. It's a silent gif of one of the actresses from Game of Thrones saying "end a half," and it's like the tagline underneath is like, "Whoa, you can hear her accent even though you can't hear what she's saying, because she mouths end a half." And nice. Her lips are nice and rounded, and it's like, if you know what she's saying and you're American and you look at her lips, it's like, oh my goodness. It's like you can hear the British accent coming out of her as soon as she gets to the last word. Anyway.
All this is to say, this is not, as David has pointed out like 10 times, not a romanization. Mm-hmm. It is a system. I was just questioning the logic behind a C to a K switch being too jarring, but some of these other things not.
Yeah. So let's, I suppose, should we get down to it and talk about actual romanization choices?
Yes, because, one, we only have about 15 minutes left, but mm-hmm. two, I think that these principles that you have up here, of course, let's, you know, skip the fifth one because it's not about destandardization when, mm-hmm. you know, when you're doing the romanization here. But having as few diacritics as possible, as you've seen in some of our length time seasons, we've had to use diacritics, if for no other reason than to make sure that stress is put on the right syllable, like in ingala, where stress is unpredictable for some word forms, but it's mostly predictable for others. We've also used diacritics to mark tone, and we've also needed to use diacritics for like the E vowel in wokutishi. So like we have used them, but also we've used them sparingly. And I think like in ways where it makes sense. And so it's not like what David put up as his example of how leather might be spelled. Mm. The second one, again, was no new characters. In other words, try to make it the 26 letters of the Roman alphabet, which is why it's called Romanization, not Cyrillicization or Greekization or anything else. You try to stick with those letters.
Cyrillicization and Hellenization.
Hellenization is a much better way of saying that. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Again, if you do need to use something beyond that, just because there's like you're up against a wall and there's just too many, use something that's recognizable, and for goodness sake, use it in a way that makes sense. And mm-hmm. so like, you know, David's example here, don't use the letter Z to represent the th sound like that. Just don't. Mm-hmm. And then also regularity is huge because, again, it's meant to be something that anyone could look at and predict how to be able to say this word, because it's not necessarily that you're teaching them the language, you're not teaching them the orthography, you're trying to make it so that when they read it in their heads or whenever they, you know, say the character names aloud or say a particular word out loud, that they say it in roughly the way that you had envisioned it.
Mm-hmm.
And so those principles keep in mind. And now, David, did you have some best practices beyond that, or like some examples you wanted to show?
Yeah, I'm going to pull out the International Phonetic Alphabet to go over some kind of.
If you click on that, spot. It should.
This is, I think, a little bit better.
Well, except it boxes out some of them.
Well.
And so the PDF.
Honestly, if characters are getting boxed out in the IPA table on your Wikipedia, you probably shouldn't be using those characters. I mean, really, but
let's... Oh, it's because those characters don't actually exist, I don't think, in all of them. Anyway,
they don't. Yeah. But the reason that they don't is because they're so, flamingly uncommon that they probably shouldn't be making an appearance in your conline. But here we go. So, we have the IPA here. Our old friend.
Scooch it over even more. There you go.
Yeah. And just okay. So the question is how to make these choices. Obviously, for most cases, if the Roman letter is the exact same as the IPA letter, you go with it. There are some circumstances where you might make a different choice, in particular Y and J.
Yeah.
So in general, if you expect an audience of American, of English speakers, Y is more recognizable as a glide than it is as the high front rounded vowel. If you're talking about Northern Europe, then the J is probably more likely to be recognized as the as a glide.
Mm-hmm.
Even there, there's still some interesting points. So I think U with an umlaut is going to be recognized by many more people as a high front rounded vowel than a Y.
Yeah.
Y is a peculiarity of, I think, just Finnish and Swedish, right? I'm not sure if anybody else uses Y as a high front rounded vowel.
That's a really good... And just to be clear, in case you missed a little bit of what David just said there, it's not that other languages don't use the E sound. It's that yes. When it's used, like in German, it's often written with the U with an umlaut, not with the letter Y.
Yeah.
And the only languages that he could think of off the top of his head were Finnish and Swedish. And I momentarily paused because I couldn't remember how Swedish spelled words. And so I couldn't remember that fact. But Finnish definitely uses the Y as the E vowel. But yeah, it is not mm-hmm. super common, like even though it's...
Yeah, so part of the goal with IPA, when they were creating it, was to not have as part of the letters diacritics. The only exceptions they made were for any I's or J's, lowercase I's or J's. So you have the high vowels E and U. Both of them have the basic I shape. One of them has a bar through it, but they both have the dot above it, which is a diacritic we've come to accept. Same with the J for the regular J, so the ya, and also for the fricative ya, they put the dot above it. They didn't for the plosive ya. And I don't know why. They didn't necessarily have to do that, but they did. Anyway, so those dots for those four characters are the only standard IPA characters that have something akin to a diacritic. So for that reason, they probably were never going to use the U umlaut for the closed front round vowel, and I'm sure they just looked to Finland and Sweden and said, well, they use it, why not? We're already using the J for yes, so let's do it. But yeah, in that case, the U umlaut is probably more recognizable. So I think, are those the only issues? The only other potential issue is with X. X is widely recognized as something other than H.
Yeah.
in many different languages.
Like, whatever it's recognized as. Yeah, you're right. Like,
yeah.
It's often something else.
Yeah. So that one's harder. I mean, it's extremely convenient to be able to have that, just drop an X in for a ch. It's just not very recognizable, which is a shame. Because, you know, if it were, that would be something nice to use. Especially not given X's usage as romanization systems started to become orthographies in places like Southern Africa, where X is routinely used for a click. And so it's just like, I don't know if there's any language that consistently uses X for X. And then you have the nonsense going on with Albanian, where X is Z, and then XH is J. It just gets very, very confusing. So anyway, that's something to caution away from. So then often when pressure arises to have either a form of the diacritic or a different character for a similar character, the first question is, does it make a difference in pronunciation? So some languages have as their H-E sound, instead of just huh, it might traditionally be voice, huh, you know, like that. It might be pharyngeal, huh, or even epiglottal, which is huh, and that's just their H, right? If that's the only H, you can just use H, and make a note and say that the H is used this way. And here, it's you're essentially defying the idea of it should be spelled the way that it sounds, in favor of recognizability, and also not using a diacritic or a different character. Basically, these things outweigh the other. And so it's easy to just drop an H in there and say, you know what, this thing is actually pronounced like a pharyngeal. There are some languages that distinguish them. Arabic is one of them. Arabic distinguishes a pharyngeal H huh, from a regular H huh, and in key positions. Mm-hmm. So it's both of them are full phonemes. And so this is an instance where it's like, all right, something has to be done to distinguish these two. And I think that's kind of like the next place where we're going. It's like, where are you forced to distinguish these things?
And, going back to that example with the H's, it's like in Hegel, where we don't actually have an F. We have the bilabial fricative, which is the phi in IPA. But it's like, but we don't distinguish between f and f. And so why not just use the more recognizable letter and again make a note that in fact it would be pronounced as this bilabial F instead. But also, again, with our goal being when people see it, they can get as close as possible to our intended pronunciation. It's not a huge deal, I don't think, if somebody says, you know, Hagolf versus Hagolf. Like, they are so similar in terms of sounds that it's like, you know, quite honestly, you're going to be getting close enough. And romanization, close enough is what you want. It's not that you're going for perfection. Otherwise, yeah, you would just use IPA.
Yeah.
and write every single note out.
Yeah. And in fact, you can imagine if, let's say, there was, you know, some sort of Roman form, and this were a real language, spoken somewhere. If you use F, and then people pronounce it with a regular F, they're not going to sound like a native speaker, but it's going to be close enough. Mm-hmm. If you go ahead and write something like a phi in there, there's a good chance that somebody won't even be able to pronounce it. They'll just look at that and be like, what is that?
Right.
You know, is it a P? Is it an O? Is it like a funny O? So like the F is going to get you closer. Mm-hmm. And that's really what you want. I mean, theoretically, nobody who's taking a look at this for the first time is going to be able to pronounce it like a native speaker. You just want them to get close so that they can, and then if they want details, they can go to the part where there are details, which is the section on the phonetics and the romanization and so on. Anyway.
And so yeah, that is one thing to keep in mind is the you know, you're trying to get the approximation.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to point that out from Howell. Where were you going from there? Yeah.
So then it's when is there enough of a reason to do something different? And then mm-hmm. what do you do?
Mm-hmm.
So often it will be like, well, my language is distinguishes these things. And so lots of Slavic languages distinguish different types of what we would spell as just like an SH, you know?
Right, right.
And it's like, all right, this is not a positional variance. You really do have to distinguish these things. And so then the question becomes what to do. And so like that, I think it depends by where you are. In the IPA. So like with SH, right? Or with sh sounds, right? We have SH. You have S with a ha-check over it that's recognized. And then you have other sequences that may or may not be recognizable. SY is somewhat figure-outable if Y is a glide.
Right.
SZ is not. And this is why. Because SZ in Polish is, which one is it? I don't remember which one it is. It's either the retroflex or the apical one, but I think it's retroflex. So I think it's sh. SZ in Hungarian is famously and bafflingly S. Regular old S.
Mm-hmm.
So if you see something spelled SZ and it's in Hungarian, you just pronounce the S. Regular S is pronounced sh, of course, because why not? Indeed.
Then the Z.
Z is pronounced Z. Z.
But isn't there like a...
ZS is pronounced zh.
It is backwards. Okay. Because I remembered it was something backwards, but I couldn't remember.
Yes.
Exactly.
And that is why Zsa Zsa Gabor is spelled Z-S-A, Z-S-A. The theory is like, if S is sh, then SZ is sh, but pronounced the way you do Z. So, s. If Z is z, then ZS is Z, but pronounced the way sh is. So, z.
Makes perfect sense.
There you go.
Woo.
So, it's like, that's kind of like, with that region, yeah. Hatchek, it's like, if you want to admit diacritics, hatchet can be good. If you need two, SH and SY are pretty good. Things that are not as good are the hat, the chapelo of Esperanto. It's basically only used for Esperanto. And so it's not as easily accessible or even easily understood as the S with a hatchet. S with an acute accent also not as well understood.
Right.
Like, I think we're at a point where English speakers will see an S with a hatchet and know that it's going to be some sort of sh.
Yeah.
An S with an acute accent might be understood as sh. It might just be understood as just S, but it's funny for some reason.
Mm-hmm.
And so I don't think that's going to get you there. And then... We're running low on time, so I do want to get to this point. What I will say is that this makes more sense with the vowels. All right. But I know that we're running short on time. I'm going to jump ahead. There is a phenomenon in conlanging where if you look at the vowel inventory of English, you'll see English has a lot of vowels. Depending on the variety of English, right? It's got between like 10 and 14 vowels. Same thing happens with Dutch.
I think some go up to 15 for, again, depending on variety.
There you go. Same goes with Dutch. And if you look at other languages, like, wow, look at all these languages with all these vowels. And if you take a look at those vocalic inventories without any thought given to the history of this language,
mm-hmm.
you might come away with the interpretation, English has 15 vowels. My conlang can have 15 vowels. And so I will look at all the vowels and pick 15 of them, and those are my vowels. And I will have minimal pairs for every single one of these vowels. Each of these vowels will always be used in any position. And so I need to wow, to romanize this, I need 15 different ways to write these 15 different vowels. So one of them is going to end up being W with an acute accent, and another one's going to be like an H with a frog on it or something, and, you know, it just turns into a disaster. This is not a problem of romanization. This is a problem of the conlang, all right? Mm-hmm. Especially if this is not some sort of, like, you know, procedural type of thing, and it's like something has gone wrong with your conlang. If it's like, oh, yeah, my conlang is 15 vowels, but, you know, they're all there and I just have to use them. It's like, no, you don't. That's really not the situation. Like, when you are thinking about when do I actually have to make this distinction, what you have to do is look at where all of those vowels are used. So, like, you could imagine a situation like this, all right? We have two different protoforms, S-E-N and S-E-N-D. And then we have a sound change where there were super heavy codas, or maybe let's call them, or maybe like, you know, stop codas. The vowel became lax. And so on top we have sane. The sound change doesn't apply, so it's still sane. On the bottom we have sained, but there we have a super heavy coda or a stop or whatever, and so it becomes send. Then we have another sound change that deletes those super heavy codas. And so then we suddenly have a modern language with sane and sen. Previously, let's say it was a five vowel system. And now, assuming that this happens with the other mid-vowels, sure, let's say you have a seven-vowel system. Mm-hmm. Not only that, the conditioning environment where this distinction was made is gone. So I'm going to call this these three systems A, B, and C. For A, five-vowel system, use the five vowels. You're fine. For B, technically this is a seven-vowel system. Mm-hmm. Still use the five vowels. Why? Because the conditioning environment for when the A lowers to E is present. It is always there. And so it just doesn't matter. Like, it's not important enough to make this distinction if you can just say when there's a super heavy coda or a stop coda, A is pronounced like E and O is pronounced like all. Simple. When you get to C and you have sane and sen and that is it, you have a seven vowel system, and this is where now you have to consider how to distinguish these. And you can do that in any number of ways. But like, this is kind of like the key factor here. Because when you're looking at a language like this, it's really important to know that it was a five vowel system at one point. It's like if you look at English's vowel inventory, it is crucial to know that English was at one time a six vowel system with long and short degrees, mm-hmm, right? And that it is because of all of those factors and, you know, what happened with, you know, codas and the great vowel shift, that's why we have all the different vowels, right? Yeah. Anyway, and so it's like you don't actually introduce the distinction in the romanization unless it becomes crucially important. So for this example, at C, it becomes important. And then for something like this, honestly, like there are any number of ways you can decide, all right, double E, it's not going to be a long vowel, it's actually going to be A, or you can do EI, that's another way of representing the A vowel, or you can say, like, I'm going to use a grave accent with the lax ones, and that'll represent that. Or an acute accent with the A plus ATR ones, and that will represent that. There are some ways. Anyway.
Right. And then if you do introduce those diacritics, just making sure you're consistent. So don't use the acute accent on the E to pronounce it sane, and then suddenly on the O, it's the acute accent means O instead of O.
Right.
Like that would be really silly to kind of mix and match that way. And so if you do have to introduce diacritics because that just makes most sense for the system, using it in really consistent ways is super important.
And all of these like creative ideas that you might have for your romanization system, these ideas are still valid and useful when you're designing an orthography. So, like, looking at this very small little sample of this mini language that we've created, you can imagine a number of different orthographies, one of which, in the modern language, they still spell all of these silent letters because they're there to tell you how the vowel is pronounced. Mm-hmm. Another way would be like, well, actually, at one point, we decided to just write these vowels differently. And so there's like, this is a funny version of this vowel, this is a funny version of that vowel. And you might actually see what Jesse just described, where it's like there's some diacritic on an E to say this is the high one. And now that same diacritic is applied to an O, but it means the low one. That's basically what happened with Hungarian, right?
Right.
And so, yeah, you actually do see those type of things in orthographies. But the point is, if you're just trying to share the work and it's and you're not sharing the orthography, right? It's just like, this is how you to this is for you to understand what my language is doing. That's not the appropriate place to do it.
Right. And so with that, we're going to need to kind of end on that point because we've, again, gone over and there's still so much more to say. But yeah, I think we've done a good job in encapsulating some thoughts on trying to be consistent and, you know, thinking about how you apply any sort of strategies for your own conlines.
Yeah.
And so thank you all for being here and hope you have a wonderful start to August. And until we see you again, stay grammar.
Bye, everybody.